Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 95 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Feel free to email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us, join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can listen to us on prn.fm at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, or after it's broadcast, you can pick us up on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know your listener till I hear from you. So send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show. And if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And remember, I really do like to hear about new guests, new topics. A lot of my new topics have come from listeners' suggestions, and I'm still working on some of the topics. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. And if you're just a listener, I shouldn't say just a listener, I want you to know how valuable you are, and I want to hear from you. So send me a message sometime. I didn't get any messages this week, any feedback of the week, so I want some people to get out there on their Facebook account or on their email or on Twitter and send me a message. Let me know what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show. Today I want to talk about something completely different, an old sculpture. How old? Well, that's really the whole point of this discussion. And although you might think a discussion about a sculpture is about art, this is as much about science as it is about art, and perhaps the limits of science. The Capitoline Wolf is an iconic bronze sculpture that shows the founding legend of the city of Rome, which you probably know is the story of Romulus and Remus, two infants who were thrown into the woods to die by their evil uncle, and they were rescued by a lactating wolf. She fed them, they survived. Romulus, for reasons I don't quite understand, killed Remus, and the reason it's called Rome is because of Romulus. If Remus had killed his brother, it would now be called the city of Reem. For a long time, most archaeologists thought that the sculpture was 5th century BC Etruscan, which would make it about 2,500 years old. But in 2006, Anna Maria Caruba, a researcher who was working on its restoration, revived the theory that it was made in the medieval period, which would be, in her idea, the 9th century AD, or what's now known by politically correct archaeologists as the Common Era, and BC is the before Common Era. I personally much prefer BC and AD, but things change over time. Since 2006, the medieval date has been adjusted upwards as far as the 13th century, which is about 400 years. But a lot of researchers still believe it's Etruscan. And the debate exposes a fault line in beliefs approaching dogmas held by archaeologists about how ancient Etruscans and Greeks made their bronze sculptures. And if I refer to things being ancient, I'm referring to the BC era, the Etruscans, who were basically Italians before the Roman Empire, the Greeks, who also were present in southern Italy, and the Romans. But nobody is saying this sculpture is Greek or Roman, so ancient and Etruscan probably mean the same thing. This statue has a lot of political power. If you buy a cheap souvenir in Italy, it's almost in Rome, it's almost certainly going to have an image of the Capitoline Wolf on it, or a lot of them will. Maybe that's not political power, but for 500 years in the Middle Ages, it presided over the death penalty, and the term ad lupum to the wolf referred to a death sentence. During the 1930s, the fascist dictator Mussolini, who was a bit of a idiot, but also a very dangerous man, sent three copies to cities in Romania as part of his attempt to form what he called a Latin fascist alliance. The 1960 Olympics were in Rome, and the wolf, the statue of the wolf, was the emblem of the Olympics. To try to reclaim the symbol of the wolf from fascists, the left-leaning AC Roma football team now uses the emblem. And yes, in Italy, football teams, soccer teams, are either left or right wing. I don't think there are any that are neutral. And there are thugs on the left and there are thugs on the right. And so you can imagine that when two soccer teams with slightly different political outlooks get together, there could be some fight. The wolf is quite large, about 130 centimeters long, which is a little over 4 feet, and 75 centimeters high, which is over 2 feet. It looks a little bit stiff, but it has extremely natural anatomical details, especially around the ankles, the ribs show through the skin. But there's no attempt to show realistic hair. Instead, there's a few bands of highly stylized hair shown as repetitive curls on a small part of the body, and this is very important because the Etruscans liked to do this. The sculpture weighs over 300 pounds, about 150 kilograms, and is made out of bronze, which is mostly copper, but also in this case contains almost 10% tin and 5% lead. A lot of people see it as an artistic masterpiece, probably partly because of the realistic anatomy of the wolf and how these artificial curls actually make it look more realistic, not less. And I think if you ever go to Rome and have a good look at it, you'll understand that when you see it from a distance, it looks totally natural, but when you look up close, you'll see these strange curls, but somehow they create a natural appearance. So the way these sculptures are made is by a process that's now 5,000 years old and is still used today, known as the lost wax process. So briefly, you take a clay model that's kind of rough, that looks a little bit like a wolf, and you cover it with wax, and then in the wax, which is very easy to manipulate, you carve all the details that you want. Then you cover the whole thing with more clay, so you now have maybe a big cube of clay, and inside it is wax, and inside that is more clay. You then heat it up, and obviously you need to have left some holes for this to work. You heat it up, and all the wax melts out, leaving a shape of the wolf inside, and into that you pour bronze. And you might ask, well, how do you stop the internal core from just falling when you melt all the wax? They usually use pins. Sometimes they use iron bars. This is also important. So the way this sculpture was made was very much according to this technique. But instead of pins, they used iron bars. And so if you look at the legs, inside the front legs is a U-shaped iron bar, and inside the rear legs is a U-shaped iron bar. The clay core was attached to that, and therefore it didn't move when the wax was melted. So if we look at Etruscan sculptures, so we're going back 2,500 years. There's a very similar sculpture known as the Chimera, which has a lion's head, also a goat's head. It's kind of a weird-looking thing, and a snake's head for its tail. This was discovered in the mid-1500s in a town called Arezzo, and if you've ever seen the movie Life is Beautiful, that was shot in Arezzo, and that is part of the heart of the Etruscan area. We know it's Etruscan because it has written on it the name of the Etruscan sculptor, or somebody's name, the name of a god maybe, in Etruscan letters. They used a different alphabet than the Romans and the Greeks. As I mentioned before, for the wolf, the anatomy of the Chimera is as natural as it could be for an animal that doesn't exist. The claws, the face look very realistic, but the hair along the back and the mane around the lion's neck are made out of highly stylized shapes which are repeated many times. You don't notice this at first, but if you look up close, you'll notice that instead of trying to show hair in any natural form, they just repeat these stylized shapes multiple times, which obviously would have been quite easy to do from a sculptural point of view. You're working in wax, so you just make a stamp, and you just basically stamp the wax multiple times. There are also other statues of the same age, showing that the Etruscans and also the Greeks and the Romans had the ability to make a sculpture as big and complicated as the wolf. However, this researcher, Anna Maria Coruba, thought that the way that the sculpture was made was medieval and not Etruscan. And I don't want to get too much into the details of how this was done, but she believed that in ancient times they actually used a much more sophisticated method than I had described. Basically, you would make a model, and a clay model, and then you would make a negative model. You would make the outside, and then you would press the wax on the outside, and then you would fill the center of the model with liquid clay. And clay is not really a liquid, but it's so much water in it that it behaves like a liquid. You then let it dry, and the reason for doing this is because you can mass produce sculptures this way. The outside model can be reused. You melt the wax, you pour in the bronze, you break it open, you then reuse the outer part, and since the inside clay is just a liquid, there's no problem with just pouring the liquid in. She also believed that there were sculptures in the medieval era that looked similar to the wolf that were of similar complexity. One of her biggest pieces of evidence, though, is that there was nothing written about the wolf in medieval literature before the 9th century. And then all of a sudden, there are many references to it. And as I mentioned, it was politically important because it oversaw the death penalty in Rome. And it was referred to as the mother of the Romans. Obviously, the function of the wolf regarding Romulus and Remus. However, other people think that the reason why there was nothing written in the literature is because 500 years before, a pope had been trying to suppress pagan festivals, and the wolf might have been part of one of these festivals called Lupercalia. And in Latin, wolf is lupa, so people think that Lupercalia had something to do with the wolf. So in order to help suppress the festival, he took away their toy, the wolf, which was an important part of the festival. And then maybe 500 years later, somebody had forgotten about why it was put away, and so it was brought out. So this researcher, Anna Maria Caruba, got into a little bit of trouble when she tried to find similar sculptures from the 9th century. This illustrates how much information was lost during the Dark Ages, because the best sculpture that she could come up with in the 9th century is a rooster. It's much smaller and much simpler than the wolf, but that's basically it for 9th century medieval sculptures. There are some sculptures from the 12th and 13th century that do look somewhat like the wolf. There is a big lion, the Lion of Brunswick, which also is made with iron bars inside it. It looks a little bit cartoonish, but it is about, it's bigger, actually, than the wolf. So it shows that by the 12th century, people had figured out how to make big sculptures again. Like the wolf, and this is an important detail, it was made in one piece. In ancient times, usually sculptures were made in multiple pieces and then soldered together. There were two reasons not to do this in the medieval era. First of all, the most use of bronze in the medieval era was the production of church bells. And a church bell has to be made in one piece. If a church bell cracks or you try to make it in two pieces, it won't ring. So in medieval era, they developed techniques to produce very large pieces of bronze. But the other reason was that they had lost the ability to solder, which the Etruscans, Egyptians, and Romans had down to a fine science. They would make massive sculptures, and even today, the only way to tell which parts have been soldered is by X-raying them. Their ability to join the parts together was that great. So we've got the lion in the 12th century, and in the 13th century, if you go to a town called Perugia in the middle of Italy, there are two sculptures, a griffin, which is another mythical beast, which I guess is part eagle and part lion, I think, and a lion that were made at about the same time. Also, they're of about the same size as the wolf, and they show some indications that they were made with a very similar process. So now what we have is we have the ability of the ancients to make sculptures that were this complicated, and also the ability of people at least in the 12th or 13th century to make this. So we're not really any closer to trying to figure out, was the wolf ancient, 2,500 years old, or not so ancient, just 1,000 years old? So Caruba had made a big deal about the fact that the wolf was made in what they call one pour. So in other words, there was one model, the bronze was poured in, and you got your object. as opposed to many Greek and Etruscan statues, where, as I said, they were made in pieces and then soldered together. The problem is that the ancients clearly had the ability to make single pieces that were bigger than the wolf, and it appears that sometimes they did make things in one piece. Now, they also did use internal iron bars. If you go to the south of Italy, there is a pair of bronze men, naked men, nobody knows if they were warriors or athletes, known as the Riesi bronzes in the Naples area. They're greater than life size, they're about 7 feet tall, and inside them are massive iron bars which were used to stabilize the sculpture both during the pouring of the bronze and afterwards. And although they were made in multiple pieces, one of the pieces is the entire body and a leg, which is much bigger than the wolf. I think if you look up the Riace bronzes, R-I-A-C-E, on the internet, you will be incredibly impressed by the quality of these statues that were discovered under the sea in the 1970s. There's a bit of a mystery about how they were found in relatively shallow waters, how they were there for 2,500 years without being damaged, or maybe not quite 2,500 years, but over 2,000. How were they there that long? Is it possible that some smugglers had taken them out of a much deeper wreck and transported them to shallow waters while they were in the process of finding a buyer for them, because they were so big they didn't want to store them in a warehouse or anything like that? So what we basically have is one of the fundamental arguments that these statues have to be medieval, that they were made in one piece, it really doesn't hold water. And the fact that they were made using what's known as the direct method, which is the one-off method, not the indirect method, which allows you to make multiple statues, that's also being used to say they must have been medieval, but that method was clearly used with the Riesi bronzes, for example, so it's also not diagnostic. When you look at a sculpture, you don't really think about all of the details that go into an analysis of the sculpture. It looks nice. You spend 30 seconds looking at it. Isn't that amazing that they made that 2,500 years ago? And then you go on to the next room and look at something else. People have also looked at the flaws in the bronze. The wolf's rear legs, both of them, have holes in them. And some people believe that the Etruscans and the Greeks were such great sculptors that they never would have left the holes. And because they had the ability to solder, they could put a patch over the holes and they could solder it, and you would never even know that there had been a problem in the first place. And these problems occur because when you pour hot bronze into the sculpture, if it doesn't reach all the nooks and crannies of the interior of this block of clay, it's too late to add the bronze later. By the time you smash it open and the bronze has cooled, you've got this flaw, and so you've got to fix it. You can't just pour molten bronze on it. That doesn't work. So the ancients had the ability to do this, and they could do it very skillfully, but in medieval era, they didn't have this, and the sculpture of the griffin that I mentioned earlier also has a very similar hole. But other people have pointed out that not every sculpture in the Greek and Etruscan era was perfect, and not all of the flaws were fixed. It was a lot of work, and so if you were putting a statue where nobody was going to see the rear leg, for example, you might not bother to fix it, because it's going to be in kind of an alcove looking out, so why would you care what the back end looked like? A lot of analysis has gone into these what I've called stylized hairs, and if you look closely at an image of the Capitoline bronze, especially around the neck, you will see this repetition of small curls. And there's a line along the back, there's a large number around the neck, there's a line around the face, and there's a line behind the rear legs. And in each case, the curls are slightly different. The question is whether these curls look like the curls on ancient sculptures or on medieval sculptures or both. So this researcher who was promoting the medieval theory did find a few medieval sculptures that had somewhat similar curls, but there's vastly more examples in the ancient sculptures, even though the vast majority of ancient sculptures have been destroyed over the years. For example, many bronzes were melted down to make church bells. But there's still enough left to know that in the 5th century BC, a lot of sculptures were made with similar stylized hair. It also pointed out that the medieval use of these stylized curls is much cruder, much simpler. For example, there would be two symmetrical rows of curls in a medieval sculpture, whereas in an Etruscan sculpture or Greek sculpture, the curls would overlap and look much more sophisticated, blend in a lot better. It's not something you notice at first. So stylistically, most people feel that this looks a lot more Etruscan than it looks medieval. And so what else can we look at to try to get information about the age of the sculpture? Oh, what about looking at the metal? One of the problems with metal is probably because it's not crystalline, it's not possible to really determine the age of something from the metal. But you can look at the type of alloy that was made. As I mentioned, the alloys in this case are mostly copper, but 5% lead and 9.2% tin. Problem is there are both medieval and ancient sculptures with similar quantities of metal. Now, lead, and here we get into some of the interesting science, has an interesting property. It's made of four different isotopes. So an isotope is an atom of an element like lead, which has a different number of neutrons. The neutrons don't change the charge, so lead with extra neutrons weighs a little bit more, but has no difference in chemical properties. So there's very, very subtle differences, but basically from normal chemical usage, lead is going to be the same no matter which isotope it is. Now, lead is a mixture of all four isotopes, and the ratios of those isotopes is a fingerprint for which mine that it came from. So in the case of bronze, lead is often a contaminant of the copper. So if you know where the lead came from, you know where the copper came from. And it turns out that the lead and the copper came from a mine in the town of Calabona in northwest Sardinia, which is a large island now part of Italy, which is almost due west of Rome. So it's plausible that it came there. We can't really date from this information, but we know when the mine was in use. The problem is that the mine was used by the Etruscans. It was probably also used during the Middle Ages. So we cannot eliminate either of those dates from the analysis of the lead. But it's certainly interesting to know that any piece of lead, as long as it's not a mixture of lead from different mines, can be fingerprinted to the modern or ancient mine that it came from. Most of the information about the sculpture, apart from what comes from looking at the outside of the sculpture, looking at how it represents the anatomy of the wolf, how it represents the hair of the wolf, most of it comes from the core, which is clay, and so it gets turned into terracotta when you pour the bronze in, which is at about 2,000 degrees, and I can't remember whether that's Fahrenheit or centigrade, but let's just say it's really, really hot. So the clay gets turned into terracotta, kind of like the rough clay, cooked clay, terracotta, that's what it means, that would be found in like a roof tile or something like that. Now the clay is also mixed with fibers, and the reason for this is because when you pour the bronze in, it's so hot that it produces a lot of gases. And those gases need somewhere to go. And sculptors discovered that if you mix fibers into the clay, not only does it make it easier to work with the clay because it sticks together instead of like dripping off where you put it, but the organic material will largely burn off and it will leave holes in the clay, and then the gases can escape. Probably when they first tried doing large bronzes, they had a few explosions, and an explosion of bronze at 2,000 degrees coming back out the hole because of all the gases it's producing could be fatal to a lot of people. So I'm sure they learned this lesson pretty quickly. So the clay itself, the actual minerals, have been analyzed, and they come from very close to the city of Rome, which means that probably the sculpture was made in or near Rome, which isn't too surprising since it's been in Rome as long as anybody can remember. Again, doesn't really tell you too much except that the Greeks were never in Rome. That's how they know it's almost certainly not a Greek statue, although it's possible that a Greek sculptor would come up from the south of Greece to work on the sculpture. But it was almost certainly made in the Rome area, which means it's either Etruscan or Roman. And the Romans like to use a lot more lead than either the Greeks or the Etruscans or the medieval people. And since it has a relatively low quantity of lead, it's almost certainly not Roman. So that's as far as we can get with the metal and basically just looking at the clay. There's not much that you can tell from the fibers. In ancient times, they tended to use animal hair, but in the medieval era, they used more things like grass, pistachio shells, other things like that. But in this case, it appears there's a little bit of animal hair in it, but mostly vegetable, so it doesn't really tell you too much. So what about dating the sculpture? Well, I mentioned earlier that you can't date metal, but there are the terracotta core can be dated in two different ways. First of all, there is a method of dating known as thermoluminescence, which is used for dating pottery. And when it's been tested on pottery, which has a known date, it produces dates that are within 5 or 10% of the actual real date. I don't know exactly how this works. It's got something to do with the electrons in the crystal at the time of heating. So the crystal basically has a memory of the time it was heated. It's quite a complicated process and has a lot of issues. You need to know, for example, the amount of radiation in the area that the sculpture was made at that time. So it's not super precise, but it's pretty good. The problem is, in this case, the dates came from the 7th century BC, which is way before anybody's, 200 years before people think the sculpture was made, if they think it was Etruscan, up to the 16th century AD. So it's a huge range of time, which basically means there's something terribly wrong. This technique was not really designed for dating terracotta. Maybe the terracotta doesn't reach a high enough temperature. Nobody's really has a good explanation of why it doesn't work. But just from the wide variation of dates, we know that it didn't work. So what about radiocarbon? How can you do radiocarbon dating of clay? Well, the clay has fibers in it. Whether they're animal or vegetable, they contain carbon and they can be dated. And although I said that the high temperatures carbonize, burn off a lot of the organic material, some of it remains in the form of carbon, pretty much pure carbon. The problem with these dates is that the dates have ranged from around 0 AD up to the 16th century. So that's, again, a range of about 1,500 years, which is a huge error rate for these datings. However, none of the dates are in the BC era, so the dates would appear to exclude the possibility that the sculpture was made in Etruscan times. Problem with carbon dating is if contamination occurs, you cannot tell. So, for example, if you were to take some ancient carbon that you knew was 1,000 years old and mix it 50-50 with modern carbon, you would get a date of 500 years ago. It would be the average of the dates. So what that means is if there's contamination, the date is going to move forwards in time. And so it's possible, although it seems a little bit unlikely, it's possible that there's so much contamination in the core of the clay that the radiocarbon dates have been moved up, in some cases, I guess 2,000 years, from 500 BC to 1500, which would be a 2,000-year error. There are precedents for having 2,000-year errors in radiocarbon. There was one example of some bones that were dated at one point as 8,250 years before the present date, but later they were dated by radiocarbon as 17,000 years before the present. So that's like an 8,000 or 9,000 year difference, much more than we have here. And as I said, there's no way to determine if you have contamination, and we know that there was contamination. One of the problems with the core of a sculpture is that it's porous, which it needs to be, and therefore pollen, bacteria, little bits of textiles, spores would get in there. The sculpture has holes in it, so there would be airflow, and over the years, small amounts of carbon would be deposited in all of the pores of the of these chunks of clay that are left inside, which is where they did the dating from. Also, an analysis of the inside found seeds. And so that means that either rodents or insects or some other kind of animal brought the seeds inside, almost certainly. Also, body parts of insects and other small animals were found inside. If animals were inside the sculpture, they probably left urine and feces. And in some cases, those would have been deposited on the clay. And because the clay is porous, they might have been absorbed inside. And if they're there long enough, it's not necessarily easy to distinguish the old carbon from the new carbon, especially if the old carbon is maybe 500 years old. It could easily be adhered so tightly to the old carbon that you really can't tell the difference. One of the strange things about the carbon dating is that nobody's really released any information. It's almost like there's some kind of conspiracy going on. In other cases, I found that every sample is listed, and it will say where the sample came from, what the individual date was found using radiocarbon or thermoluminescence, and then somebody will draw a diagram of all of them. This usually happens when you get good results. In other words, results that are clustered tightly around an expected date. This is actually a real problem with radiocarbon dating. It seems like it's so scientific that you should be able to just do radiocarbon dating, and you shouldn't have to worry about looking at the curls on the sculpture. You shouldn't have to worry about trying to analyze the metal. Just do the radiocarbon and you're done. The problem is that the results are often so far off that you end up with a situation where, as if the radiocarbon results match what you expect, you accept them. And if they don't match what you accept, you reject them, which is hardly a very scientific notion. So we're left basically with three theories. We have the Etruscan theory, and then we have two medieval theories, either the original theory that was made in the 9th century when the first literature references occurred, or that was made in the 12th or 13th century when there are comparable bronze sculptures that were made. And the lack of comparable bronze sculptures to me means that the 9th century date is unlikely. But then you have a problem of how do you explain the literature references? You have to assume that the sculpture was put away by a pope named Gelasius because to suppress the Lupercalia cult. Of course, we don't really know that that was the case, so it's just a supposition. Even the rooster that I mentioned, which is the only 9th century sculpture which is comparable in any way to the wolf, even that's questionable. It was found, it was taken down from a 12th century bell tower. People believe that it was there before the bell tower, and it was when the new bell tower was constructed in the 12th century, it was moved. But it's not clear that the evidence for this is very solid, and it's just listed as probably 9th century. What if it's not? What if it's 12th century? Well, then we have no comparable bronzes. I should point out that I talked about church bells, but church bells were actually only starting to be constructed in the way that we would consider them to be church bells, i.e. large cast bells, in the 9th century. So if the wolf was made in the 9th century, we have to assume that people were just starting to learn how to cast symmetrical church bells, and then at the same time, they created a sculpture of a wolf. The alloy of metal that's used is very different for the wolf. It's totally not symmetrical. A lot of the processes that would be needed to make a hollow structure like the wolf are completely different. It's really hard to believe that people could go from maybe making a rooster and a bunch of church bells into making something as complicated as the Capitoline wolf. And if you look around for other examples of a wolf with Romulus and Remus, you can, for example, find a what's known as a relief sculpture. What that means is that the shapes pop out from the background a little bit, but they're not entire sculpted shapes. And there is one 9th century, what they call a diptych, which is just two pieces of wood put together, made out of ivory, but it's incredibly crude. It's described as the paws are way larger than they should be compared with the legs. The children are done in a very unrealistic way. The face has been described as looking more like a crocodile than a wolf. The tail looks like a plume. The ears look like a rabbit. It's really completely unrealistic, and that's completely medieval. If you look at a lot of medieval paintings or medieval reliefs or medieval carvings, you will notice that there's no sense of perspective. There's no sense of realism. Perspective wasn't rediscovered until the Renaissance. And a lot of other artistic capabilities also were not discovered until the Renaissance. So what makes me so interested in this is because it's so mysterious. I think in summary, what we have is a sculpture that's clearly Etruscan by style, but probably medieval by date. So the only possible explanation I can think of for this, and I'm not the first person to think of this, although nobody wants to talk about it too loudly because there's not really much evidence for this, apart from the fact, I think Sherlock Holmes said, or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, that when you eliminate all the impossible, whatever's left must be true, despite how improbable it is. So could we be dealing with a copy of an Etruscan sculpture? So how did the people in the medieval era learn how to do sculptures? Well, they might have taken an ancient sculpture and used that to learn the techniques of building bigger sculptures. So what happened to the original Etruscan original? There should be two identical sculptures. One, if we dated it, would be 2,500 years old, and one would be 1,000 years old. Well, part of my hypothesis is that in order to figure out how to make the sculpture, they had to take the old one apart. And when you take a bronze sculpture apart, you're destroying it. You can't put it back together again. As I said, the sculpture is made in one piece. So if they smashed it up, if they like took the images off the outside so that they knew how to make all the shapes on the outside, and then they cut it in half, and then they could see inside, they could see the iron bars, and they could see the clay, and they could see all these other things, maybe from that they could figure out how to make a sculpture. But in the process, they would have destroyed the sculpture that they were making a copy from. It's all totally hypothetical. But one of the things also that came out of this was the dogma about how medieval sculptures were made versus ancient sculptures. And the importance of the dogma is that if the dogma was true, it meant that there was a distinct difference between medieval and ancient sculptures, and you didn't need to think about it. You do a go-through checklist. You say, okay, it was made in one piece. There was no soldering. It was made with iron bars inside. Often, I didn't mention this, but there's little holes in the side which were used to insert the iron bars. Flaws were not fixed. So you go through the checklist. If you check everything off, it's like, okay, it's medieval. It's not Etruscan. But it appears that that is a dogma, and in reality, it's very rare that you will have two things like this that don't overlap a little bit. And if things overlap, then you have to actually think about what the sculpture is, and that's a whole lot more difficult. And I think this is how scientific dogmas arise. You make some observations, and your aim is to come up with a quick test. Psychologists do this. Is this depression or psychosis? We'll have a checklist. Is it ADD or ADHD? We'll have a checklist. The assumption being that you can always distinguish between the two things, but in many cases you have a gradient, or in the case of art, you have artists copying other artists. It can be very difficult, for example, to distinguish between a Renaissance sculpture, a Roman sculpture, or a Greek sculpture. The reason being is that the Romans slavishly copied Greek sculptures, or they used Greek artists to make their sculptures. And then the Renaissance dug up some of these sculptures and slavishly copied them. So the reason they look the same is because artists copy in order to learn how to make new things. And then after they figured it out, they then go on to extend the art. So much of the Renaissance was actually a period of copying the great works of the classical era, the Roman and Greek era. And beyond that, people got more adventurous. Then later years, later centuries, we have Impressionism, abstract, things like that, where people don't feel like they have to keep repeating what the ancients did anymore, that they can extend the art in different directions. So dogmas in science are very comforting. I've probably mentioned these dogmas before, but in 1912, two dogmas arose. Or perhaps I should say one was reaffirmed. This skull called the Piltdown Man was dug up. It was the missing link. The British loved it because it meant that the origin of humankind was in England, which now sounds kind of ridiculous, and probably a lot of people realized it was ridiculous then. But it wasn't until 1953 where they allowed a scientist to drill through the skull, and he discovered the bone inside the skull was white. What that meant was that this skull was a fake that had been dyed on the outside to look ancient, but actually, if somebody had taken the time to drill a hole in it, they would have discovered it wasn't. And this basically required the death of the original archaeologist who'd been fooled, because he didn't allow anybody to have a look at the skull. You could kind of come into his office, have a look at it, but you couldn't pick it up. You certainly couldn't do anything destructive like drilling a hole in it. Was he part of the cover-up? Who knows? Maybe he was fooled as much as anybody else. But for 40 years, the Piltdown Man was accepted as valid, even though it didn't really fit in with anything else that people were discovering. Also in 1912, the same time the Piltdown Man was discovered, an Austrian meteorologist named Wegener came up with his theory of continental drift. He looked at many different things. You can look, for example, at the coastline of Africa and South America, and you can see that they look like they fit together. You can find many rock formations that are found both in Africa and South America, or in Europe and North America. You can look at many plants that are found many thousand miles apart, but occupying similar habitats in North America and Europe, or South Africa and South America. So we put all this information together, and it was soundly rejected by geologists. And it became a career-killing move to talk about continental drift. But then, all of a sudden, in the 1960s, geologists, one by one, flipped over. By the end of the 1960s, everybody was talking about plate tectonics, which is really continental drift. I guess it was a face-saving gesture. The geologists could say, well, we never believed in continental drift, but we believe in plate tectonics. And ironically, the reason why continental drift or plate tectonics became accepted was not anything to do with scientists. It was to do with the U.S. Navy, which was doing magnetic explorations of the Atlantic Ocean and probably other places. And they discovered these bands of magnetic fields that pointed north for a little while, then south, and then north, and then south. So it was alternating bands of magnetism in the rocks pointing in opposite directions. And then people realized that what was happening was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a range of mountains, and that they're forming a new land. And when the rock solidifies, it picks up the magnetic field of the current era, which must mean that the magnetic pole has flipped from north to south many, many times throughout history. Nobody knows what happens when the north and south pole flips. You probably wouldn't even notice it, but all of a sudden your compass would be pointing in the wrong direction. Is it instantaneous? Does it take a few hundred years? Like, will for a few hundred years our compasses be pointing towards the middle of the planet instead of one of the ends? Nobody really knows how this is going to happen, but it's almost certain that sometime in the future it will flip. But from this pattern, the only explanation was that the seafloor was expanding. That meant that the continents were moving apart, which meant that Wegener's continental drift theory, which had been rejected for 50 years, was actually true. And this is, you know, dogmas. In this case, it was a lot easier for geologists to say the continents are where they are. They've always been there. This makes our job a lot easier. In the case of the Piltdown Man, it fit in with England basically being the center of archaeology and anthropology. They wanted to feel like not only did they have the best scientists and the best researchers and the best museums, but they were also the place where humanity had originated. This was at the height of the British Empire. It seems a bit absurd now. So was the work of this researcher, Anna Maria Kuruba, in vain? Let's assume that she's wrong and her 9th century theory, which I think is the weakest of the three possible dates, is wrong. Does that mean that she was wasting our time, wasting her time in this investigation? Well, if there's going to be science, you have to explore every alley, and some of the alleys are going to be dead ends. And so I think scientists that step out on a limb need to be praised. Scientists need to explore different areas, and they need to failure needs to be accepted, because you have 100 small failures that don't really cost that much, and then you have a grand success, which hopefully can benefit humanity. Hopefully it's not the discovery of a more powerful nuclear bomb. So I hope this little discussion of this sculpture, the Capitoline Wolf, has been interesting. I think it's interesting from a lot of different perspectives myself. And I hope that if any of you are ever in Italy, you will remember to go to see the Capitoline Wolf at the same-named museum. And if you're in the south of Italy, you can go see the Riesi bronzes, which are really magnificent, and it's hard to believe that they weren't made yesterday. They're so surreal, so realistic, that when you look at them, you really think you're looking at a giant human being, as opposed to a bronze sculpture. How is it that I know so much about this one sculpture? Well, when I find something interesting, I just can't stop myself from doing the research. So I just had to keep going until I basically reached an end. And at the end, I'm still not certain about what the answer is, but that's okay. The journey made it all worthwhile. Almost everybody was justifiably horrified by the coordinated attacks in Belgium that at last count had killed 35 people and, just as importantly, had wounded many more. And many of those people will go through the rest of their life with the physical scars and the emotional scars. And even people who aren't classified as wounded may carry a lot of emotional scars for a while. People ask why we don't have as much sympathy for similar events that occur routinely in countries like Iraq, Syria, Libya, and just recently in Lahore, Pakistan. I think people are paying more attention to this issue. There is definitely, I think, a bias in the Western media towards attacks that occur in what we consider civilized countries and those that are considered war zones. And we don't like to pay too much attention to what role we play in those wars. But terrorism has metastasized like a cancer, and it's followed the pattern of the U.S.-initiated wars, with the Europeans either enthusiastically going along or cowardly finding some excuse not to get involved without directly criticizing the United States. And I guess I have to throw my own country of Canada in with the Europeans. On some wars we've joined enthusiastically, and some we've stood on the sidelines, but no Canadian politician in recent memory has had the courage to say what America's doing is wrong and there's going to be blowback. And that blowback is not just the terrorist attacks in Belgium. And why is it blowback? Well, these people are radicalized partly because of the horror of what Western armaments do in Muslim countries. And I think a big part that people don't often talk about is not just that the Western armies are killing people in Muslim countries, but that they are humiliating the entire Muslim religion, the cultures that are largely Muslim. I think this is something people don't pay enough attention to, because when you humiliate people, they want to lash out. And oftentimes, these jihadists in their own countries, Belgium or France, are really petty criminals. They probably feel excluded from society. And what do they know except violence and crime? Perhaps this is their way of looking like Rambo. Ironic that Western movies may in some ways stimulate this feeling that you can walk in to a room with a weapon and become a hero. And that's not to say it's the fault of just the West. Jihadism is very much a problem in the Islamic religion. It's not a problem of the vast majority of Muslims, but it is. There definitely are preachers who preach this hatred and this violent rhetoric, and there are some impressionable people who buy it. It's not just the Muslim religion. In America, more people have been killed by white supremacists who have their own violent, maybe not a religion, in that it's maybe not entirely Christianity that motivates them, but it is a set of beliefs that it is white men against the rest of the world, basically, that motivates them to walk into a black church and kill people, to blow up the government building in Oklahoma City, etc. As Westerners, unfortunately, our reaction in many cases tends to be, we need to go in, as President Obama said, we need to root out ISIS for once and for all. But if you root out ISIS and leave all the conditions that created ISIS in place, you'll end up with something worse. That might be hard to believe, but there probably are people who could be more evil and barbaric than ISIS if you create a vacuum. How do you get out of this black hole that's being created by all of these wars? You can't just walk out of Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Libya and not see a vacuum. In fact, that's exactly what happened in Libya. Western forces overturned Gaddafi very quickly, and they left a vacuum. And in that case, they didn't want to be involved. They didn't want to have their armies involved. But in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan, they did. But the end result was remarkably similar. I'm not sure what the solution is. I don't have a magic answer. But one thing I can say is that marching into more countries and destabilizing more countries, like some people in the U.S. military-industrial complex plus their fans in European countries and Canada, would most definitely love to go into more countries and destabilize them. Who are the winners of this kind of thing? Well, I guess the jihadists see themselves as winners. This kind of attack motivates people who believe in jihad and love to see people blown apart. Obviously, ISIS has been is notable for its elevation of barbarism to new levels. Their opposition, the far right in Europe, is also likes to see these kinds of attacks. Maybe likes to see isn't quite the right word, but they benefit greatly from these kinds of attacks. And there's already been the invasion of a bunch of far-right skinheads into a peaceful rally in Belgium. Their idea that all Muslims are dangerous is, of course, magnified by the actions of a handful of Muslim jihadists. They can use this to paint all Muslims as dangerous. Who also will win is the military-industrial complex, and it's kind of an irony that Belgium plays an important role in the world's legal and illegal arms trades. Those are the people who will benefit. Who will lose? Well, the biggest losers will be Muslims in European countries. In many cases, these are people who grew up in those countries, have citizenship only in those countries, who find themselves marginalized within those countries, in Molenbeek, the kind of ghetto near the center of Brussels, where many Muslims live. Some people believe that Muslims want to live in the ghetto, but many Muslims believe it's difficult to get out. It's hard to get a good job. It's hard to find housing outside their ghetto. If society continues to marginalize Muslims, you can guarantee that there'll be more aggrieved young men who will resort to violence. I'm not sure that trying to welcome Muslims in society is going to have any impact on those who are already radicalized. And then we need to talk about intelligence. This was obviously a massive failure of intelligence. When intelligence services tend to benefit from their own failures, they can now ask for more money, for more people. But if they don't have people working for them who understand the cultures, such as the local Muslim culture, and don't have connections, these kinds of attacks are just going to continue. And those who feel like they should be monitoring everybody's phone calls and text messages will also feel that this is a good excuse to do more of that kind of monitoring. But what we see in these cases is that some major indications that these individuals were problems were missed. And if we spread out more and more intelligent resources more and more thinly, we're actually not going to be any further ahead. What if the intelligence services cultivated, hired people who knew these cultures and actually followed up on every possible lead of something exciting happening, rather than accumulating billions of communications of ordinary people and hoping that they'll be able to find something in those? In this case, it appears that the small group of jihadists, maybe it's a little bit bigger than a small group, but it's still probably a handful of people, they used what are called burner phones, which are prepaid cell phones that you can get relatively anonymously. And even if you have to provide ID, you can provide false ID, because one doesn't imagine that somebody selling cheap cell phone services is going to take too much time to look at the ID. So you get these phones, you use them a few times, then you throw them away. And even if they couldn't do that, they could always steal phones. As I mentioned, a lot of these people are petty criminals, so getting hold of stolen cell phones is probably not that difficult. And even if a cell phone only works for 24 hours or so after it's stolen, it can still be used for communications. In many cases, you can put a SIM card in a stolen cell phone and use it for some considerable amount of time, especially if it comes from another country. So even if the intelligence services monitor every phone call, it's not really going to be that easy for them to track these circumstances, these networks down. What they need to do is follow up on leads and do old-fashioned policing. One would hope that all of these violent circumstances, these violent attacks, would end, but I'm afraid that the American war, which is seen by many Muslims as a war on Islam, is going to continue to bear bitter fruit for quite some time. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.